Convention of the California Council of the Blind. You ready to have a good time out there? Yeah. All right. So we will start with our invocation today. And to present our invocation, we have Reverend Brian Jessup from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Fresno from Clovis, California. Reverend Jessup.
Thank you. It is an honor to be here, and among my credentials and bona fides, I was privileged for the last several years to have Ed Ames in my congregation, and what a powerful witness and presence, and what a wonderful human being. And so as we take a breath today and bow in spirit, let's remember Ed and hear these words of prayer. Great power of life and love, power who moves within our hearts and minds, power that leads us to growth and understanding and peace. We give you thanks for this time and this gathering. We give you thanks for the relationships and the companionship, for the collaboration experienced here. We give you thanks for new friends and long-standing friends that we encounter. As we engage our work together this afternoon, may hearts and minds be alert and open. May new understanding and new strength be developed. May individual lives here be encouraged. May the work of this group be enhanced so that the independence, the security, the life opportunity of blind people may be increased, and so that the culture and laws and customs of our society might become more and more inclusive of the blind and of all people with special needs. And while we are at it here this afternoon, great power of life and love, may we find a lot of pure fun and enjoyment in the work. For you are the source of our breath and the source of our song. You are the energy of the bull elk and the butterfly and the hummingbird. And we know that you know everything about fun and enjoyment. And for that, and for your love, and for your healing power too, we give you thanks. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Reverend Jessup, and thank you, man, for mentioning Ed Ames. You know, we'll be hearing about more about that incredible crusader later on in this convention, but he certainly was someone that we will all miss. Thank you. We are now very honored to have with us representatives of the United States Marine Corps, those men and women who do so much to make this world and make this country safe so that we can have conventions like this. We now present for the colors today, the Marine Color Guard.
In air, gave proof that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave?
I think we can be seated now. What a stirring rendition. Wasn't that wonderful, you guys? That was really great. Isn't it? Her name was Hannah Vanuelo. So let's give her another round of applause. That was really great. And thank you also to the Greater San Joaquin Chapter, Tom Randall, and everyone for organizing this, because this is just wonderful. Okay, we're now going to have the distinct honor of being welcomed to the fair city of Fresno by the mayor herself, Mayor Ashley Swearingen. Madam Mayor?
Thank you, and good afternoon. Welcome to Fresno. How many of you, by a show of hands, traveled to be here today? All right. Well, welcome, welcome, welcome. On behalf of the people of Fresno, we extend our heartfelt greetings. We're so glad that you chose Fresno for the site of your conference, and it's just a pleasure to host all of you here. And I want to say the city has been so pleased and fortunate to work closely with members of the blind community. One of the primary vehicles that we've done that is through our Disability Advisory Commission. In fact, I'm sure many of you in this room are familiar with it and are active participants. The commission advises me, the city council, and our staff on issues affecting persons with disabilities and seeks avenues for improving services for people with disabilities in the larger community. Mary Beth Randall, who is a member of the Central California, California Council of the Blind. Yes. Hi, Mary Beth. How are you? Speaking of angels, she just stepped up. This is Mary Beth right here. And she's the wife of Tom. Thank you very much. She's delivering me a package right now. The president of the hosting chapter, we want to thank you guys so much for organizing and providing support for this conference. And I also just want to add on to what Reverend Jessup said. We've had two very special people that we've lost in Fresno in our community recently. And, of course, Dr. Ed Ames, a longtime advocate, the first recipient of the Disability Advisory Commission Achievement Award, who means so much to our community. And then also Russ Holzer, the member of our Disability Advisory Commission, former director of the Valley Center for the Blind. Those two gentlemen have left us temporarily. They have left an incredible mark in our community. They've left such a legacy, and I know that that legacy will continue. So we honor them and want to thank Tony Ames and recognize you also and just let you know how much we appreciate you and your husband. So we're constantly looking for ways in Fresno to make sure that we can improve services, infrastructure for persons with disabilities, including transportation, paratransit, and those sort of things. So we welcome you here today. There's also a couple other special people I want to introduce. I'm sure you probably know Stephen Frazier, who is a city employee, City of Fresno. He joins us at the front table. And he was hired in August of 2006. He's believed to be the first blind person to be an employee of the City of Fresno. He works as a customer service representative. Yeah. And he works in our call center. So if you live in Fresno and you ever have questions about a city service, you can call 621-CITY, and there's a very good chance that Stephen will answer the phone. So thank you, Stephen, for being here. And then also, how many of you know Elizabeth Kuntz, our ADA coordinator in Fresno?
Yes.
She's here. And is just a terrific asset for City Hall and for many in our community. So thank you, Elizabeth, for being here. And with that, let me step aside and, again, welcome you and hope you have a very successful conference and wish you all the best and God bless you and your families in this coming year. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mayor Swearingen. With a couple things before you go. Just a couple quick things. First, Steve and Heather McKenzie, you have a quick presentation you want to make?
Got it. Thank you, Mary Beth. I'll
have
one other.
Absolutely. Do that, too.
Oh, thank you, Priscilla. You're taking the time to share that with us.
A lovely bouquet of flowers has been presented to the mayor. I'm doing the audio description here, you guys.
That's so, right, the play-by-play. So these are absolutely gorgeous red roses and lilies, and I'm very honored. Thank you, Stephen, and thanks to all of you. And Mary Beth reminded me, we do have a proclamation for your organization from the mayor's office, and I'm going to leave it up here with Jeff, and it welcomes you, and once again, thanks you for your service to our community and our state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, you want to read?
Thank
okay,
you.
Let's
absolutely.
Read it.
Let's read it. Why don't you read
that, very good.
If you have time.
Absolutely. Let's read it. Okay, it says, whereas the California Council of the Blind is the largest organization of the blind in California, having 42 affiliates throughout the state, including one headquartered in Fresno, and whereas the California Council of the Blind was founded on October 6, 1934, in Fresno, California, and during their 75 years, the California Council of the Blind has worked tirelessly and successfully to improve the lives of blind people everywhere through education and sponsorship of legislation, and whereas the California Council of the Blind will hold its 75th convention in the city of Fresno, the city of its birth, at the downtown Radisson Hotel. We're very proud of that. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Ashley Swearingen, Mayor of the City of Fresno, do congratulate and commend the California Council of the Blind for the hard work they performed during the entire 75-year history of their existence, and do hereby proclaim the week of October 26th through November 1st, 2009, to be California Council of the Blind 75th Anniversary Week. Congratulations.
And we'll certainly put that, have a place for that in our office, no question about it. Okay, so the fun is going to continue now. We are now very pleased to have, and I want to thank Gene Lozano for arranging this, as he arranges so much of it. And that's what I get all the credit, and he does all the work, which is just the way I like it. We now have Sharon Hagel. Sharon is curator of collections and education for the Fresno Historical Society. She has been in her current position for the past 9 years and associated with the Historical Society for 20 years. In addition to her curatorial duties, she serves as the historic site manager at Kearney Mansion Museum, supervises the museum's tour program to public school and school, excuse me, to public schools, develops and installs exhibits at community venues, and implements educational programming. Her publications include a 20-page study guide and 12-page educational newspaper magazine related to the Society's annual, quote, Civil War Revisited. I didn't know they fought the Civil War in Fresno. And Time Travelers at the Civil War, Living History Event. Editor, production manager for M. Theo Kearney Prince of Fresno, and editor chair of A Portrait of Fresno, 1885 to 1985. And with that, I present you, and we're really looking forward to hearing a little bit about the city of Fresno, Sharon Hagel. Sharon?
Well, hello, everyone. I presume my microphone is on. Correct? Good. All right. I'm used to performing without a mic, so you're going to have to bear with me here if I start speaking too closely to it. Well, let me add my pleasure at being here to the mayor's greeting to you. Again, I work for the Fresno Historical Society, and we're just a little bit older than you all. We're kind of like an older brother. We celebrate our 90th birthday this year. Recording, I know. Wow. and sometimes staff kids that we kind of feel like we're that old, you know. And I'm sure all of you, most of you, I bet, in the audience are familiar with working for nonprofits and how it's a labor of love, and we all take vows, right? So anyway, first of all, before I get going on my general topic, which is Garden of the Sun, the San Joaquin Valley, and particularly Fresno County. Again, I want to congratulate the organization here for coming back to your birthplace. You know, I bet, and I'd like to share with you some notes that I made about your first meeting. Now, I bet you have some information in your program, et cetera, for the conference, but you know, I bet it was a day like today in October. Because it was in October, the beginning of October, right? When the first group came together here in 1934, I bet it was a bright, gorgeous, cool day in Fresno, an autumn day. And, you know, it was though we were challenged, as all of California was, with all of the issues of the Depression at the time. We were facing unemployment. There was a building stoppage, construction, and all that. But we were fighting our way out of it. Your first council came to a city of only 52,000 at the time. And now, of course, we're up over 250,000 people here in the area. And we only were 9 square miles big, and now we're triple that size, almost quadruple the size. So there's been a lot of growth for you all and for Fresno in the 75 years that have gone by. You know, again, let me remind you of some of what went on at that first meeting. There was a group of only 29 people who met here in Fresno to consider the formation of a California Council for the Blind. The idea had originated with the chief of the Division for the Blind in the state, and her name was Miss Kathleen Michaels. Her plan was to form a group in which sighted members would predominate, but the blind would have some representation. Well, that didn't quite happen at the first meeting. It's a very interesting history. Again, it was so interesting to read the history because of the 29 people present, 16 were blind people and only 13 were sighted people. And the blind had come at the insistence of a significant figure, as I'm sure some of you know, in your past, Dr. Newell Perry, who was... Yeah, see? I knew it. Right. And remember that he was director for the advanced studies at the California School for the Blind and a leader in the blind community, a blind person himself. So anyway, so Dr. Perry had been organizing for the past 10 years. So he was very involved, of course, in this movement leading up to the 1934 organizational meeting. And most of the sighted people present were engaged in the work for the blind in the state. And they had already held several preliminary meetings to discuss the formation of this council. And I bet some of you are going to recognize this next name. At that meeting, though, the one that was held in October here at a beautiful hotel, by the way, the Hotel Fresno was our premier hotel here in Fresno. In the Jade Room is where it took place. So your first council met at the high water mark of hotels here in Fresno. But at that meeting, a Professor Jacobus Tenbroek, right, one of Dr. Perry's proteges, well, he led the fight, as I know you all remember, but it's interesting to say it out loud. I don't know if anyone has reviewed your history verbally with you all yet at this 75th anniversary, but remember that there was a substitution. There was an altered Article 1, Section 1 of the bylaws, which gave the blind the majority on that original council by adding two representatives from two additional organizations of the blind to the roster. And this majority then led to, of course, course, the election of Dr. Perry as the first president. And my goodness, he held that post for years then, until 1953. So, you know, there was such an incredible amount of work done when I looked at the and figured out the stats that, you know, you all, the first council only met for 6 hours. And out of that, they had an hour and a half lunch. Right. But in that then, 4.5 hours, whatever the subtraction is, a constitution was passed with this discussion and change in that article, that all-important change. The constitution was adopted, the council was formed, officers were elected, and committees were appointed. So I tell you, you all were off and running in 1934, weren't you? It was amazing. Bravo. Anyway, so I wanted to share with you that, you know, that the fact that all of the nonprofits in Fresno are just so happy to have you all back here for your 75th anniversary. And what I have been invited to do is give you all a sense of what this part of California was like in its very, very early years. Hence the title, The Garden of the Sun, the San Joaquin Valley, but again, I'm going to focus on Fresno County and give you an idea of what the beginnings were here. And sometimes the best way to do that is to tell stories, right? To tell stories of the people. So that's what I'm going to focus on, are one or two key people stories as I tell you about the beginning of this part of the Garden of the Sun, the center of it, the heart of it, which is Fresno County. And a key element, really the core of the story here in the San Joaquin Valley for people, for human beings, is transformation. It's the story of this fertile land and the people here in Central California. And this goes back from the geological upheaval of the land to the work of human hands. The land shaped those of us who came. The land shaped the people from the beginning. And of course, we turned around and have incredibly altered the land with all the challenges that came with that. As a geology preface, we should remind ourselves that the story of Central California begins, and again, the numbers here, the couple of numbers that are going to come at you are just, you can't hardly wrap your mind around them, but the story begins 100 million years ago when the molten, of course, rock, the granite, was formed beneath the earth in California, and as it cooled, it rose above the surface, creating the core of our incredible, remarkable Sierra Nevada mountains. And as the mountain ranges were created, the glaciers moved over the land, though, and began to carve out the channels of our two great rivers that mean so much in our history, the Kings River and the San Joaquin River. Then, for more than 10 million years, these great rivers deposited sediment, and what is euphemistically, and we've worn out the analogy, but it's our gold, right? The sediment that came down out of the mountains and spread onto the valley floor from these rivers over that just humongous time period, 10 million years, and transformed California's Central Valley into one of the most fertile valleys, the seven fertile valleys on the planet. We are in that incredible small number where we are one of the seven most fertile valleys on the planet. Right here in California is our great Central Valley. And the acreage is amazing too. We have 15 million acres of land. The valley is 450 miles in length and about 40 to 60 miles wide. And as I've already mentioned, Fresno County is located in the heart of the valley. And consistently, is we of course, this is one of the rah-rah things, but it's incredible to think about, too. We're the most productive agricultural county in the nation, year after year after year. Sometimes we dice with Tulare County or what, but usually Fresno County is number one. But again, that's because of always those two factors, the land and the people who came and transformed the land. And this, the story of Central California then is a story of its inhabitants. All those who made this valley their home have left their mark on it. And this is beginning, of course, with the Native Americans, who were the first human beings here. They have inhabited the region for centuries, and once there were over 300 tribelets in the area. And you know, they too, though, interacted with the land. There was some, if you will, very gentle alteration, but there was some crop planting. There was some interaction between human and the environment and the landscape. However, the first non-Native Americans who came into this part of California saw this huge expanse of plain. And it was quite unexpected because they'd come from the mountains, the Sierra Mountains. They'd come from the coast mountains, up from the south, down from the north. And here, all of a sudden, there was this huge plain in front of them. The Spaniards, beginning in the 1700s. Then, of course, the Mexicans, the Americans coming west, Asian, Chinese, and, of course, all of the other European immigrants beginning in the 1800s. And what they saw, these early explorers and trappers, they described miles of native grasses, huge expanses of wetlands at the time, and the roaring rivers. And, you know, one gentleman described a beautiful, beautiful description years later when he was writing. As he, and I wonder if you can guess who this is, as he embarked on his first walk, and literal walk in California in the spring of 1868. You know, he had just gotten off the boat in San Francisco. 3 days after he was off the boat, he was ready to leave the city. And he walked out of San Francisco, and this young Scots immigrant, who this lady in the front row, of course, has already said his name, John Muir, wrote this description years later when he was writing about his first experience. One shining morning at the head of the Pacheco Pass, a landscape was displayed that after all my wanderings still appears to be the most divinely beautiful and sublime I have ever beheld. There at my feet lay the great central plain of California, level as a lake, one rich bed of golden soil. Along the eastern shore of this lake of gold rose the mighty Sierra, the grandest and most telling of California landscapes. As Muir walked toward his first experience in the range of light, as he so eloquently, as we all know, named the Sierra Nevadas, there was growing activity in this area in what would become, in what actually already was, Fresno County in 1868. But there was growing activity on the plains. This region's gold mining settlement of Rootville, which had developed along the San Joaquin River in the years after the big gold rush, right, when they shouted Eureka up there in John Sutter's Fort, and literally in that title of the wonderful book, The World Rushed into California, right? But as the gold miners fanned out over California looking for more of that gold, there was a gold strike up here in our San Joaquin River in the Sierra foothills, and Rootville began to develop, a typical mining settlement that developed into the first county seat in Fresno because it was the largest human inhabitation when they carved Fresno County out in 1856. So the town of Millerton, it had changed its name by then, the town of Millerton was our first county seat, but that didn't mean it was a staid, established town. This was the Wild West in 1856, yet it certainly was. And Millerton was a good example of that. Gold dust was still the medium of exchange. You went in and you plopped your gold dust down when you wanted new pants or a drink at a bar. And the, of course, because we were a county seat, there were supervisors elected and all. But you know what? In the summertime, they got thirsty all the time. And literally in the Millerton Times, they talk about those supervisors would adjourn 12 to 15 times a day to go next door to the exchange, which was the largest saloon, because they were thirsty. So again, it was, and they loved to adjourn for the horse races that went through town also. All right. So it was, again, it was a Wild West town. Everybody still wore their guns and all. And you know, we were a typical gold rush town also in how we began to treat other groups of people who had come to mine the gold fields. You know, they took the Europeans a while to rush across the nation from the east to the west. Before that, we had, of course, Sonorans from Mexico. Chileans were coming up to mine in the gold fields, people with experience in gold mining. And of course, the Chinese began to hear about Gold Mountain. Those first Chinese immigrants who wrote home and talked about, somehow it got, the description got totally developed into the description that you could pick up gold nuggets off the street. So the single men in China, and men with families, of course, because that was during a period in Chinese history when things were pretty dire, as far as famine and land, available arable land. So you had nothing to lose by getting on the boat to come to Gold Mountain, all right? But, of course, in the give and take of human interaction and gold being at the root of all of this, Millerton experienced the same types of political and community action and government action that the rest of California experienced. And, of course, I'm referring to exclusion action. There was a large Chinese community, and one year the city dads got together in Millerton, and it's very interesting. In fact, the archives that where I work at the Fresno Historical Society, we have this original document of a meeting that took place. This wasn't an official supervisors meeting. It was the city dads, if you will, got together and decided it would just be best if the Chinese all relocated to another part of the land outside of Millerton. So they were through a series of a couple of meetings excluded from Millerton, which again reflects the history of the state. Though at the time, that was as most of you know, there were significant statewide exclusion acts that were passed. But all of this was happening up in this small gold rush town, and then history began to take its hand, though statewide history, and begin to change the whole complexion of this region for two reasons. Number one, the railroad was plowing its way. I want to say that's an agricultural allusion, but the railroad was coming through the valley. The Central Pacific Railroad, the Big Four up in San Francisco, of course, Leland Stanford being the biggest one we all recognize, they decided it was time, of course, for totally, obviously commercial reasons, to connect the north part of the California with the south part of California, and that began to transform the Central Valley. In fact, as the railroad pushed through the valley, that is how all of the railroad towns were established, and Fresno City was one of those towns, a railroad town. Now, before that, though, we had beginning agricultural development here with dry farming. Again, activity as people, all those people poured into California, and then their relatives came, etc. There was farmers and ranchers that came, and they began to experiment with the soil here. And of course, one of the easiest crops in terms of water, and of course we'll get to that in a little bit, one of the easiest crops is wheat. Wheat is a dry crop, doesn't require much water at all, certainly no irrigation, if you're lucky, right, if the rains are good. So there was dry farming going on. The dry farming pioneers began to clash with the cattlemen. One of the first industries here in the Central Valley was the cattle industry. And that too is an outgrowth of the gold rush, because, you know, all of the enterprises to take care of these thousands and thousands of gold miners grew up in California, and one of them they had to feed all of these men. So huge cattle ranches were developed. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the name of the legendary Henry Miller of the Miller and Lux. And in fact, his nickname is the Cattle King of the Miller and Lux Ranch, which was a little bit to the north of us, but it spilled into Fresno County. Jefferson James and Thomas Fowler were two cattle kings in this area. And even, very interesting story, a slave who came west with an early pioneer family, the Akers family, Gabriel Moore, got into ranching when he came to California. And by 1860, this is a fascinating thing, and it's when you study the census, of the first census that California participated in was the 1860 census, of course. And the Fresno County census is a fascinating document to study. And in it, there Gabriel Moore is listed as a rancher. And you know his worth by that time was $3,000, which was a substantial amount. So he had established himself as a major cattleman in the area, this former slave that came across the plains again with the Akers family. Just as a tiny footnote, he died in a very unfortunate cattle accident. He was on his horse in the Kings River and something slipped, and so he did not live to be of old age, but he certainly is part of the cattle story. Now, the wheat ranchers, though, the wheat farmers, they began to prevail, and there was a huge discussion, argument, fight, if you will, in the early 1870s that led to the No Fence Law, which effectively ended the cattle era, because the No Fence Law stated that the farmers didn't have to fence in their wheat. The wheat wasn't going anywhere. The wheat wasn't going to wander. The no fence law meant that the cattlemen had to fence in their huge herds. And of course, that wasn't in the cards for the cattlemen. So the cattle era ended, and the wheat ranches grew, prevailed, and we began to head towards the era of small farms in our valley, and that was contingent upon the other piece that I already started to tell you about, the transportation coming through. There had to be transportation to bring ranchers and farmers to the area, and of course to carry the produce. Pardon me. The produce out of the region. And let's go back now to Mr. Stanford, coming through the Leland Stanford, riding through the valley. It was hands-on management at that time. He was actually on a horse, riding through the valley with the survey party. I find that amazing. But, you know, Mr. Leland Stanford decided that he wanted to make sure these railroad stops were sited at the right areas. Well, he got to this part of Fresno County and noticed, and this is all written up in the newspapers of the time, so we don't think perhaps what he said is apocryphal, but his quote in the paper, but this is the story. He got to this area and looked off in the distance and saw some very green wheat fields and asked about what the heck was going on over there, because everything around it was golden, was dry. And they rode over and met A.Y. Easterby and his associate Moses Church. Moses Church is considered the father of irrigation here in this part of California. And that green wheat field was there because Moses Church and A.Y. Easterby, both of them, by the way, sheepmen from Napa County, who had heard about what was going on here in the San Joaquin Valley in Fresno County and had been drawn to this area. Moses Church and A.Y. Easterby had dug the first ditch from the Kings River to irrigate Easterby's wheat fields. The wheat fields happened to be in this wonderful green state when Leland Stanford rode through, and he said, here we must put the railroad station. And that's why we're all sitting here in the Radisson, right on this spot, I suppose, today, in terms of being very close to the Southern Pacific Depot. We actually retained the original depot, Central Pacific at the time, of course. It has been preserved and is now being used as office space, but we have our particular birthplace, again, of the town of Fresno. Again, that's not why we're here. We're here because of the land and the people and the water. That's always the story here in the San Joaquin Valley and in Fresno County. But it is kind of a fun story to tell about why Fresno is at this particular spot. All right. Now, although at the time now, you have to imagine that Fresno was established, and a very interesting part of why Fresno is now our county seat is logical too. All those smart people up at Millerton, the doctors and lawyers, of course, by this happened about 1872, let me tell you. 1872 is when the railroad stop was established here, and everybody up in Millerton saw the writing on the wall. There was no gold left up there. There was no reason to hang around in the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas. The action was here on the valley floor where the transportation was going to go through. So they got together, the people of Fresno County, and decided to vote on a relocation of the county seat. Now again, there are all those fun stories about the Central Pacific Railroad ladling out a little drop of whiskey to everybody who went and voted for Fresno. But indeed, Fresno prevailed at the election, and the county seat was transferred. So again, all of the structure of the community, which of course had been established by then. Again, I was mentioning to our wonderful the doctors, the judges, the lawyers, the teachers, everyone who was there, the mother, the families, of course, took apart their houses board by board and brought them down to the plains to build the first structures in Fresno, because there was no lumber down here at all. And the story of the logging industry, which began to get going great guns in the 1880s, is a whole other story that we can't even, but it was of course the logging of the Sierras and everything that meant for the environment and the redwoods. Again, that's a whole fascinating story, began to develop then the logging industry. But those first buildings were actually brought down board by board from Millerton to the plains here so that the county seat could begin to grow. But again, that's not really the story. The story begins to be, what was the vehicle by which the land was developed, by how all of those ranchers and farmers, the family people, thought that, hey, we can maybe make a go of it in California, in Fresno County, because advertising began to go out about the farmland here, the richness of the soil, and the water that needed to be here. There are two big stories, and there are two people I'm going to tell you about today that exemplify those stories. But first, we're going to do the land. All right, it's like almost what came first, the chicken or the egg. But so I just choose one, because you can't have the story of irrigation without how the land was developed. And that was the brainchild of a wonderful, it was actually the advertising, the development of the Central California Colony by M. Theo Kearney and two of his associates, the men who bought the land and developed it, Marks and Chapman. They are equally important. But the Kearney story, again, M. Theo Kearney, tells the story of our signature crop, the raisin industry. So that's why I choose to tell you a little bit about Kearney and, again, the colony farm system. I've already mentioned to you the wheat ranches were huge operations, all right? And syndicates owned huge tracts of land, very cheaply available, the deal between the government and the railroad during the time. They were able to buy huge tracts of land very inexpensively. But still, how were you going to entice individual family farmers to come to the area? Well, the colony farm system had been tried here in California, in Southern California, successfully. So we didn't invent it here, but we sure perfected it. Though in Anaheim, Riverside, and Pasadena, there were successful colony farms that were up and running. So Marks and Chapman had the land, had the investment capability, and they hired this immigrant, M. Theo Kearney, to develop and promote the colony farm system. A colony farm is a plot of land, probably about 200 acres big, broken up into 100 to 200 acres, broken up into 20 to 40 acre plots. The syndicate, the colony owners, provide very inexpensive irrigation. So irrigation is brought to the whole colony. Incredible rates for land purchase. Also to entice families, because you know the females have a vote in this in Iowa and Arkansas, right? Why are we going to go to California? Well, honey, they're going to provide schools for the kids, which they did do. The colony school systems. And also roads were built in the colony and into the big town, the big city of Fresno. So those are the salient points of the success of the colony farm system and why it was so successful. But it took that first colony here. And the story of that gentleman is one of the archetypal stories of immigrants to America, no matter where they came to. In the mid-1800s, M. Theo Kearney got on a ship in Liverpool, England, as a little 12-year-old boy with his Irish family. He's a little Irish boy, and he started out his life with a different name. He even changed his name. His name was Martin Kearney. The Kearney family came. They, I'm sure, sailed right through into the New York Harbor and went to a big colony, if you will, a settlement of Irish people, of course, Boston. The Kearney's father took the family to Boston. He grew up there, didn't have much of an education, and got into business, saved up his money, and then began to hear about all this from his friends, his business friends, began to hear about all of the land opportunity, to the development opportunity in the West, the last frontier, the new frontier, the West. And that's when he came to California to be hired to manage the first, again, colony farm, the Central California Colony. So he, again, he started out as an immigrant boy, laboring Irish family, came west with a little nest egg probably of about $10,000 and got into business, got to manage the colony farm system. And you know what? I'm going to leap way ahead to the end of the story right now. He died in 1906, a millionaire, having the nickname of the Raisin King, because he helped to establish the raisin industry, which is still one of our major industries here in California. He had a huge ranch just to the west of Fresno, and again, now his home is a house museum today. In fact, the Historical Society, the people I work for, have been operating it as a house museum for decades. So Kearney is one of the main stories to tell about this region. But you know, it's also stories not of only single men coming, such as Kearney, but of families and groups of families coming from all over the world. And the stories are here because of the stories the first people coming here told, the letters that were written home, the stories that were told about all the opportunity here. And you know what? The first Armenian brothers to come to Fresno came a little bit after Mr. Kearney. They came in the early 1880s, the Seropian brothers, and the glowing letters they wrote home it got a whole village so enthused that a number of different families came together. They booked passage. They came here. But oh my, this is quite something. Although the Armenian, again, people have been so instrumental in helping to transform this into the Garden of the Sun that we're referred to as. I tell you, that first summer when they arrived, it was anything but. There is a very traditional story, again, written down and told. Those first families happened to arrive in the dead of summer, and there still were not a lot of trees growing in Fresno. It was only the early 1880s, but the, you know, the husbands and brothers had written home about, this is the place to come. We're going to grow things. The women literally got off the train. It was an incredibly hot and dusty day, and they literally started crying on the train platform. What had we been brought to? But again, They then dug in, they participated, and they helped to make us the Garden of the Sun, as did all of the groups that came here, from the Volga Germans who came as family groups, and the Japanese, the Chinese we've already talked about, the Danish people. All of the groups that came started on the land. It's always a story of the land and the people and the water, which is another story for a whole different talk. And, you know, wanted to close this very brief overview, this highlight, with a quote from one of our best known authors, really in California. We all should claim him. William Saroyan was born here and wrote so eloquently of the valley. So I wanted to share something with you as I end my little bit of time with you here. And here's what he had to say. We had come to this dry area and we'd paused in it, built our houses, and we were slowly creating the legend of our life. We were digging for water. We were leading streams through the dry land. We were planting and plowing and standing in the midst of the garden that we were making. So it's been a pleasure to share a little bit with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. That's wonderful. Thank you very much. That's great. Before we bring on our next presenter, our diamond sponsor for this event, with an incredible contribution to make this convention possible, has been Wells Fargo. And we want to bring on Moises Madonia to talk to us just briefly about Wells Fargo and to thank them for their generosity in helping us make this Fresno convention possible. Moises?
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Moises Magana. I'm from the Clovis Wells Fargo branch. I have Robert Herrera here from Madera as well with me. And we wanted to thank you for having us. We also wanted to just briefly, we're here set up to pretty much answer any questions that you might have regarding the services that we provide to assist the visually impaired. Today we are also, you know, just pretty much wanting to make you aware that this year marks the 10-year anniversary that Wells Fargo began working closely with CCB to pilot the talking ATM and become...
Wow.
Thank you. And become one of the first financial institutions in the U.S. to announce a plan for developing and installing talking ATMs. Wells Fargo right now has over 6,800 web ATMs in 23 states. Today, all of Wells Fargo ATM locations have talking web ATMs, which offer voice instructions in English and Spanish for customers who are visually impaired. So we're again here just to try to help answer any questions that you know, might make your banking with Wells Fargo easier. If you have anything that, you know, we can possibly help explain or just make a little bit more, I guess, user-friendly with the information that we can provide to you, just let us know.
These gentlemen are in the exhibit room. We encourage you to come by and talk to them. And we just thank you, gentlemen, both of you, and Wells Fargo.
Thank you.
All your, not only the generosity for this convention, but all the years that they have worked so closely with us. Thanks again.
Thank you.
For being here. Okay, boy, we really give these guys a raw deal. They have to follow, you know, a mayor who's fun, and then they have to, and then we have these wonderful program on, you know, the history of Fresno and all these fascinating guys, and then all of a sudden, boy, the director of the Department of Rehabilitation has to come on and tell us about the department in hard budgetary times. That's not fair. I want to bring again back to this convention. They've both been here before. They're both friends of ours, and we certainly enjoy them. I want to present to you Tony Sauer, Director of the Department of Rehabilitation, and with him today is Anthony Candela, Deputy Director, Specialized Services, California Department of Rehabilitation. Tony's, take it away.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm going to let Tony Candela go first, but, you know, talk about budget issues. I wonder if the guys in Wells Fargo can help us out a little bit. Don't let them out of the room. Yeah. Okay. But Tony Candela is going to open and talk about some of the details of our program, and then I'll come in at the end and talk about some highlights. I understand we have about a half hour, Jeff?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tony Sauer and Jeff. President Mitch Pomerantz, President Emeritus Kathy Skybers, I heard you were here. Thank you for having us. Usually when I'm here speaking to you, I come on a little later in the agenda, which gives me a chance to sit and listen to some of the other speakers. And I often have a few observations, mostly my own personal reactions or philosophical thoughts about things that I've heard. So I only have one observation from, I have two observations from what I've seen so far. It just happened that the Marine Color Guard stopped right in front of where I was sitting. My father is a former Marine. I have a soft spot in my heart for the Marine Corps, and that group of Color Guard fellows was beautifully precise in their movements, their footsteps. I could hear the their leader giving them instructions. He was talking really low. So I'm proud of those guys, and I'm glad that they were here. Let's give them a hand. And then our previous speaker on the history of this part of California. You know, a lot of us who read audiobooks, recorded books, things like that, we're very sensitive to how words are strung together, especially when someone is saying them out loud. So here's what I just heard. I heard, for a little bit of gold dust, you could get a new pair of pants or a drink at the bar. Now, I heard her say that. I know which one I would take. And after I spill that drink on myself, I'd have to take the other one. just an extra special tribute to my friend Russ Holzer, who passed away just a few weeks ago now. I actually talked to him about 3 weeks before he passed away. He was the usual Russ Holzer. For those of you from this area who know him, he took the leadership of the Valley Center for the Blind, helped to build it up, left, started another business, which is just like what Russ would do, very entrepreneurial, very social fellow. He made friends with folks in City Hall, helped get funding for services for the blind here in the Fresno area. I talked to him just a few weeks before he died, and he felt sick. But he said, you know, I'm going to lick this. I'm on my way back. You get that feeling inside of you sometimes when you talk to somebody. And I said to myself, well, I'm sure I'm glad that I talked to him, because I'm not sure if I'm going to ever get to talk to him again. So I miss my friend Russ Holzer. He was a real treasure. He's an emigre to Fresno. He came from the Midwest, I believe. So Fresno was really, really lucky to have him. So I miss my friend Russ, and thank goodness that he was with us for a short while. Okay, now on to the dry stuff that Jeff just alluded to. We government bureaucrats, have a hard job to do these days. I mean, we always have a hard job, but it's in the service of the people, and that's what counts. I try to impart a very small message to audiences such as yourselves when I speak about your role as a citizen. Your role as a citizen, really, as a person with visual impairment, as a blind person, we remember we're all regular people first, and we're citizens next, and we depend upon our governments. We expect a certain degree of safety and security from government. That is the history of our society, and it's a wonderful society, the best in the world ever. And so we can never forget that standard that we hold our government to. So my editorial comment is that we as a people have to do whatever it's possible to make sure that our government stays as whole as it can, that the funding that is necessary for our government to function is there and sufficient, And my last editorial comment is that we somehow those legislators and elected officials, the governor, et cetera, do whatever it takes to make our government less vulnerable during economic hard times. Because as government suffers, so do the people in big ways. So that's my editorial comment. My advice to you, get to know how your government works. I'm sure Danny Kaiser and Frank Welty could give you hours upon hours of lecture upon how our government works. Get to know how it works. So goes your government, goes DOR. So goes DOR, goes the blindness services here. So let me get on to those blindness services. I just want to give you a quick rundown on what we do, for those of you who are not familiar. The Department of Rehabilitation, its primary mission is the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, employment, independence, and equality for people with disabilities. The Vocational Rehabilitation Units inside of DOR are the largest units. My division is specialized services. I have all of the blindness services under me, and I have one of the deafness units under me as well. The blindness services, the ones that you'd be most interested in, again, within that, my largest unit is my blind field services unit. That's the vocational rehabilitation unit. The district administrator, the head of that unit, is Catherine Bales, who's here in the audience. She brought her supervisors with her to your conference, so a bunch of them are here in the room. And they participated in the rehabilitation meetings yesterday with one of our staff, Tricia Leitz, helping to guide those conversations. Tricia's here, too. Hey, Tricia. she deserves your applause, but hold it for now. The unit, because I promised to get us back on time here. So the unit has within it 66 counselors, 9 supervisors, the leaders, the district administrator, and support staff. So any of you who have had a counselor for the blind in the old days, a counselor teacher, we don't have counselor teachers who were doing the work of counselor teachers anymore. That was basically the same thing as rehabilitation training, rehabilitation teaching, daily living skills. Now all of our counselors are carrying vocational rehabilitation caseloads, but those are the folks that comprise the staff in our blind field services unit. So when you say you have a counselor with the state, with the DOR, you have somebody in, for the most part, you have somebody in my blind field services unit. Typical caseload at any one time is between 4,500 and 5,000 people. Just to give you some perspective, typical caseload of the entire Department of Social Services, Department of Rehabilitation, is around 75,000. So about 5,000 out of 75,000 are blind, visually impaired people in our blind field services caseloads. And typically we help about 400 individuals a year to achieve employment, which is the main reason for that unit, to help people get to work. I'm going to jump to my next topic here, which is our transition services. Mainly, this takes place under the blind field services unit, but it's a special subset of services that focus upon youth, teenagers, who are blind, visually impaired, assisting them to go from school to work. School to higher education to work, school to vocational training to work, school to independent living to work, but school to work. And it's a set of services that are a combination of what we do in rehabilitation and what the education system does through the IEP in the educational system and through the IPE in the vocational system. Individualized education plan, individualized plan for employment. One of my many prides and joys is the leader of the transition services for blind field services, a fellow named Richard Rueda. And Richard works really hard. He takes his work seriously, he's also done me a really big favor. He took a program, a summer youth employment program, that we put together. It was a combination of our blind field services counselors, several agencies for the blind here in California, and our business enterprises program, and a lot of generosity and a lot of hard work on the part of many people to start a program 3 years ago that we've been continuing every year now, and it's getting bigger. Then it gets a little smaller. Then it gets a little bigger. Summer jobs for kids working primarily in our business enterprises program, vending stands. Yes. Okay, that brings me to our next program, our BEP, Business Enterprises Program, represented here by the Randolph Shepherd Vendors of California. They're here. You know, fellows like David Hanlon, Roy Harmon, those guys. And the BEP basically is it's a small program a business program inside of a government agency. So our job is to take folks that are in our vocational rehabilitation caseload who would like to work in business as their vocation and who would like to work in our BEP, and then we provide them with special training. They get licensed as a vendor, and then they compete for and they win the opportunity to manage a BEP facility, cafeterias, snack bars, vending stand clusters. We have several prisons where what we provide them is all of the vending machines. So these vending machines can be a very lucrative way to make money, and large dining facilities, some of which include work with the military. So those are some of the opportunities through our BEP program. I think Tony Sauer may have some numbers he wants to share with you on that, so I won't spoil his thunder. That program is what teamed up with our Blind Field Services unit and those private agencies out there to get those kids those summer jobs. So I'm very proud of how our units work together inside of DOR and how the private sector partners we work with, came and chipped in with us. We have our Orientation Center for the Blind, and I know we have an alumni group here, Orientation Center for the Blind. And the former administrator, Mike Cole, who retired a couple of months ago, says hello to everybody. And just so you know, we're recruiting for a new administrator. We're getting close to making our decision. Almost every part of that process is completed now, so we'll be announcing, assuming nothing goes wrong with the civil service process, which you never know, everything should be working fine. So hopefully real soon we'll have a new administrator. One of the things that we're doing there, I'll start the conversation. Tony may want to add a few more words on it. Is you've all heard of this federal stimulus money? It's proven quite stimulating because it's essentially doubled our workload. Money that is coming through our organization for vocational rehabilitation services, for our independent living services, on a large scale, large amounts of money. Heaven forbid what this has done to the national debt, but it's needed now. We're using it now. We're spending it now. We're pumping it through our system out into the world out there to do good the way the stimulus money is supposed to do good. And some of what we're doing with that money is some renovations to the OCB buildings. They're more than 40 years old. And one of our goals, it looks like we're going to achieve it in some fashion, is some independent living apartments inside of the OCB dormitory. We're going to actually convert a piece of the dorm. So consumers who go there for their training, especially those who've never lived on their own as a blind person before, will have an opportunity to transition out in their last few months. Suddenly, instead of being fed their meals in the dining room every night, they're going to be cooking their own meals. So... So anybody who's thinking of going to OCB, beware. Okay, our older individuals who are blind program, it's one of the programs funded through independent living services money. So that's a different pot of money from the vocational rehabilitation money that comes from the federal government. And we contract out all that money to private agencies for the blind and some independent living centers. And they provide services to people who are blind, who are 55 years of age or older, and they have increased every year. They keep increasing the number of people they serve. So we have been well over the 4,000 person mark for the last 3 or 4 years, and that is totally attributed to the hard work of our private sector partners out there. You know, with that, I think I'm going to stop and turn the mic over to Tony Sauer. Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. It is really an honor here to be with Jeff and Mitch and Gene and so many of the leaders in the blind movement in California. And I want to come back and, when I'm finished here, talk a little bit about the history. That presentation earlier was really, really wonderful. But as Tony said, we have really put our American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds, ARRA funds, or as many of you call them, the stimulus funding, to work. We were very fortunate in February to find out that we did have about $56.5 million for our Title I programs, our voc rehab programs, and then we had the older OIB programs, older individuals who are blind, and our independent living funding on top of that. So we're very fortunate in California. But the workload that has come with that has been pretty intense, particularly when we have the furloughs that have been handed down to state employees. So you have employees who are having to do much more work 3 days a month less, and when you compound that, that's 36 days a year less that those employees are working. It is very difficult, and we have just to have our supervisors here and Tricia and others from our department, they still have work to do when they get back to the office on Monday, and they have only 4 days to do it next week. So I really appreciate them going over and above and coming here and understanding the value and the importance of this group. As Tony mentioned, several things we're proud of around the visually impaired and blind community that we work with, and the $7 million that we've invested basically in the Orientation Center for the Blind from our stimulus funds. That came out of a strategic planning process that the deputies and I embarked on about 2 years ago, just as I started as director. And we were really fortunate that we had this strategic plan in place. We've been working on it, and then lo and behold, the money came through with the new president's initiative. Which has really helped us with this, as we're calling it, the Great Recession we're in right now. Our department would be, we would really be sucking wind if it wasn't for the stimulus funding. And it's helping us shore things up and move ahead, even though we are still having cuts and not being able to replace folks. We have not had to lay any employees off, but we've had to let our positions go that are vacant, over 50 positions thus far. And it's not easy, because those same folks that are working 3 days a month less now are doing the work of others who are no longer there, and it is difficult. But we're moving ahead, and we are able to meet our federal mandates. Besides the items Tony mentioned, I don't think I'm being redundant here, but we've also invested in video conferencing capabilities, and that will help us keep our costs down, keep our travel costs down. One of the sites will be here in our Fresno office, and there'll be 6 to 8 other sites around the state of California, so we'll be able to do training and conferencing from afar. About a year and a half ago, this group had a resolution about improving our bandwidth, which was giving our counselors in the field a real problem with assistive technology. And the bandwidth, for those who don't know, is our internet capabilities. And the state's infrastructure was weak, particularly in a couple areas. Well, we've also been able to use our stimulus funding to increase our bandwidth so our staff will have better assistive technology. And one of the more important things, Tricia's clapping because I know that was one of her issues. One of the other big issues that we're able to use stimulus funding for is our electronic recording system. The counselors in the field, our very skilled counselors, are using what's called a legacy system. What that means is they have technology from 1990. 19-year-old technology that they're having to use to do their data recording and keep track of the consumers. Can any of you imagine using any technology that's now 19 years old? Well, you're using Braille, which is 200 years old, but that works. but it works. Braille works. Our So So the big impetus for us is to get this electronic recording system up to speed. And now I believe our the furloughs have pushed it back a bit because our staff are working on it intently with our vendor. We're looking about 18 months before that'll be rolled out throughout the state. And it'll also give us a much more opportunity to keep better track of consumers and the services we provide. The BEP program, as Tony mentioned, one of the items that we're able to do with our stimulus funding are increase the vending sites at 7 roadside rest stops. And we may even be able to do more than that. The first one we were able to do was in Gold Run up off of Interstate 80 on the way to Reno from Sacramento. And in the midst of that process where we were going to put the funding to do that rest stop, Caltrans stepped up and actually provided the bulk of the funding. So that then allowed us to move that money to another site. And we're able to do more and more of those as time goes on. And those are some of the more lucrative sites for those BEP vendors, our business enterprise vendors. We've invested $10.8 million in our community rehab providers around the state, which is about 30 contracts are about to be awarded. I think we're dealing with one protest still. We had 120 people or 120 vendors apply for those funding, that funding, but we only had enough funding, $10.8 million, for about 30 of those projects. And many of those will enhance services for people with visual impairments. We're doing a lot more investment in staff development, staff training, not just for voc rehab, but for disability awareness, including blind and visually impaired. And that, again, as we get our video conferencing capability and our bandwidth improvements, we'll be able to put much of that online. And everything we have online will be accessible for people with visual impairments with our screen readers for our staff. And then much of that will roll out to the general public as we can. So those are kind of the highlights of our stimulus funding and what we're doing, and Tony got into more of the details. But I want to talk a little bit, I said I'd wrap back around to the little history presentation. It's fascinating to understand that in just, 75 years ago, in 1934, in the midst of the Great Depression, that this group really got kick-started. And through the people, the consumers at that time said, no, it's not going to be for people who are blind. It's going to be with people who are blind. We're going to be in control of this thing. And the resolution that took place at that time, from what I just heard, really changed the future of blindness in California and probably across the country. And then Newell Perry was elected, and it sounded like he was your president for, 19 years? My goodness. I can't imagine being president of a group for that long. But the future was changed at that point. During what many people, probably was the worst time in this country besides the Civil War, most people were probably hunkering down in 1934 trying to survive, and a group of real visionary leaders said, it's time for us to make a change. And they changed the future. Those folks, I don't know how many there were in that room at that time, but they said, we won't take it anymore. We're going to step up. We're going to be in control of our own destiny. And now here you are, 75 years later, with wonderful programs, wonderful opportunities. You have the technology you need. Things have changed because people stepped up and made a difference. Here we are in the midst of the Great Recession. Now it's time for leadership as well. And great leaders aren't born in times of sunshine. Great leaders are born in times of despair. This is a time of despair for this country, and we are stepping up, and many of you are stepping up. And I really appreciate the leadership of Jeff and Mitch and others in this room, and I applaud you for that, and I look forward to working with you in the future. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Tony. Okay. Thank you very, very much, both of you. We have time for a couple questions, but before we do, just two comments from me. First is that, remember, for all you current or recent rehab clients, we're working along with NFB and others to fill out a survey on your experiences with DOR. Camilla Riding is in the exhibit room. We're going to be filling them out. You can do it after the convention as well for another several weeks, 3 weeks or so. But we want to get as many of you as possible so that we have a survey that is gives us a very accurate picture of how services are being provided by the department. The second thing, I just have to comment, unfortunately, on the Gold Run situation. I know it was said that there was going to be an outstanding Gold Run facility. There's not one new machine that has been delivered to date. It has been a total fiasco, and I don't know whether you're aware of that, Tony, but there's been a break-in that would never have had to happen. The Department of Transportation is upset because of the way the facility has not been properly implemented, and I think that needs to be immediately addressed. Okay, we have time for maybe two questions.
Jeff?
Yes.
It's Mitch, and the two Tonys answered a couple of the questions that I had, but I need to ask perhaps the most important question. California will be the seventh of eight states that I have the privilege of visiting this year as ACB president, and in all of those states I have spoken to vendors, and I've heard the same theme over and over again. The number of vending facilities is going down, down, down. And I'm hearing the same response that the licensing agency is doing little, if anything, to add facilities. I want to know from both Tonys, what are you doing in California to increase the number of VEP facilities?
Yeah, I think the business environment out there is changing a lot, and things are changing in a lot of ways. Of course, we're in an economic downturn now, which isn't helping, but the trend that Mitch is referring to has been going on for a while. Two major things. One, increase the amount of money we have to spend on facilities so we can match all of our federal dollars. The other one is as we develop new facilities, develop them, those that are by a much more sophisticated analytical process, probable in terms of how much money they're going to actually make for the vendor. And if you have a vendor who's in there who's doing a good job, that the location is going to be profitable. And as we develop those new locations more skillfully, we phase out some of the older locations that are just not making a good living for their vendors. So what will this look like? This will look like a slow upward increase in a number of facilities over a long stretch of time. Using the stimulus money you already heard is another tool. So working to train our vendors better. We have a brand new current training session that began just a week or so ago. It was the first time for our brand new training curriculum. Emphasizes a lot more of self-employment and entrepreneurial skills than ever, so that when folks are out there, they increase their ability to be successful on their own. So trying to increase our success, trying to minimize our failures. It's not going to be anything that's going to revolutionize the program overnight, unless we get some of these big hits, like with the stimulus money. Sorry about that Gold Run thing. I wasn't up on that one myself. Apologies for that. But that is the kind of money that if we get those infusions, we can take advantage of it right away, like we're trying to do with the stimulus money.
Mitch, you addressed that to both of us, so I think I need to respond as well.
Thank you.
Okay. One of the things that I've noticed is that trend. In California, we've shrunk the size of the vending pool dramatically. And an email I saw a few weeks ago from one of the retired vendors, John Friesen, who many of you know. John wrote a very eloquent email about what he sees happening in the program. One of the trends that I noted in that is that it's a different environment. State workers don't go to work in their suit and tie and stay in their building all day. They go out. There are fast food restaurants all around many state buildings. They tend to walk at lunch. If they eat, it's something, you know, they bring a snack. So that's part of that was one of the trends. There are many things that have happened as the BEP program has evolved since 1936. The Randolph Shepherd Act, when it was first written, it has changed. And we are noticing in California, we have a lot of vendors who aren't making any money. We have vendors who are making making $18,000, $20,000 a year, that's not a whole lot of money. They can make that much just sitting home on Social Security. So we've put a threshold, I think it's around $30,000, $3,800 a month, as any new site that we're going to go after, because what would be the point of somebody getting up at 4:35 o'clock in the morning and going to work all day if they're going to make just as much as they can make staying home? So we have changed the priority for that program. We're also trying to improve the health of the retirement account and the BEP trust fund, and that's where some of the roadside stops are coming in and some of the other things. So it's not for lack of attention. Tony Candela and Deb Meyer, the new program manager, are working their tails off to improve the program, but there are some outside issues that are impacting us, including the ones that John Friesen brought up, and there are just some realities that not everybody wants to work and run a cafeteria. They want to become attorneys. They want to become lawyers. They want to do other things. So we're finding the folks with visual impairments that want to be in the program, and then making the program lucrative enough for somebody who would want to work that hard. So we are putting attention into it, Mitch, and I know it's a trend. It makes me uncomfortable. I want to see it shift, and if you have ideas, specific things that we could be doing differently, my goodness, come and talk to the California Vendors Policy Committee and work with us. We talk with them on a regular basis. Did I address that? My goodness, Mitch, you sat down. I feel good.
Well, okay. You addressed it, but I don't want to engage in a debate here.
Okay. Well, as you know, Mitch, I'll take your call anytime and we can talk.
Thank you.
Okay. We have one additional question. It'll be our last question.
This question is for either Tony's. My name is Roy Harmon. I'm a vendor in the program, BEP. I'm in Oceanside, California. My question is in relation to the stimulus package that has been discussed. Talk louder.
I'll tell you what, to save time, Roy, say the question. I'll repeat it because we don't have a whole lot of time. Go ahead.
Okay. Is there a time limit on the use of the stimulus package? And if the money is not spent with getting close to that time limit, will that money be forwarded into other locations that need the development? And also, just a quick comment on Gold Run. I was told by Deb Meyer that the reason it didn't get fall into the stimulus package was because of the timing of it.
Well, thanks for the extra on the Gold Run, the timing of it. I'm going to find out more about that. The main question Roy's asking is, are there time limits on the spending of the stimulus money, and what happens if we don't spend it all on time, or can it get pushed, can it get rolled into other BEP facilities? Should we not spend it on the ones we're planning on? There's definitely a time limit on spending all stimulus money, no matter where it's coming from, for what projects in general. Money must be obligated by September 30, 2011, and all cash must be secured and done with by December 31st, 2011. We have an allocation of money for these BEP projects, and like we said before, if we don't spend the money on one or save money because somebody else came in with some extra money, we'll push that over into other projects. The idea is to accomplish the goal of adding a bunch of facilities into this program and take advantage of the stimulus money right now.
Thank you. Thank you very much, both of you, Tony Sauer and Tony Candela. We appreciate your being here, the time you've taken, and the nice words about our organization. So thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
Okay.
Great. Okay, boy, our next presentation, what an exciting presentation we're about to have. All of you know the incredible environmental promise held. Thank you, Kathy. That is held by hybrid car technology. And you also know how equally scary it is with respect to the safety of pedestrians, and specifically those of us with blind or visually impaired. We in the council have been aware of these concerns under the leadership of Gene Lozano for 15 years or so. Before some of the other folks in Washington, D.C. and the occasional big car maker decided to come out and get on the bandwagon and say, something needs to be done. there was a little manufacturer, an entrepreneur, that really started to take the lead in this area. The Fisker Karma Fev Safe Sound, the Fisker Car Karma Company has taken the lead in attempting to design a quiet car that will meet our needs. And here with us today, we have Mr. Kevin Walsh, who is a staff engineer for the company. He is employed in powertrain engineering at Fisker Automotive, working on the solar roof, fuel economy, and acoustic signature enhancement. He graduated from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo with a degree in mechanical engineering and a focus on sustainability. And so to speak to us today and give us a little demonstration of what the car might sound like, we have Kevin Walsh. Thank you, Kevin.
And thank you very much. Thank you very much. This is a great opportunity to speak to such an influential audience. This quiet car issue, although we have very few hybrids on the road at this time, it's already made it to the national level in the form of the Pedestrian Safety Act of 2009. So great job on that. I think the blind community did a great job there. So, I work for Fisker Automotive, and we're making the Fisker Karma, which is a plug-in hybrid vehicle. It will have quiet modes of operation if we don't do anything about it. But we do plan to do something about it, even before legislation is implemented. So, thank you very much. We are also putting the stimulus money to work. We got a very big loan from the Department of Energy of about $500 million, and that's billion with a B, to produce cars in America. The fastest way to get the Karma to market was to produce in a brand independent manufacturer in Finland. But now with this loan money, just 2 years later, we're going to be able to produce tens of thousands of cars in America per year. So I'll go over the issue of quiet cars, which a lot of you, of course, are probably familiar with. Then I'll talk about how Fisker Automotive will address this issue, and I'll talk a bit about the legislation as well that's been proposed. Now, the regulatory point is the biggest point that I want to hit home in my presentation. If you sleep through the rest of this, take this with you. We do not have a way to define detectability yet accurately and repeatably. So I'm proposing that legislation be implemented that's simply qualitative. Automobiles must be acoustically detectable to pedestrians when powered on. Very simple, very easy. Thank you. Now, I mentioned the Pedestrian Safety Act of 2009. The first part of that act called for a study, which NHTSA is carrying out. That's the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And their first part of the study was to comb through a lot of data that they already have on pedestrian collisions. They found that hybrids are more likely to collide with pedestrians and bicyclists, but only during low-speed maneuvering. So that is stop and go. So we're talking about intersections and parking. And to give you a couple numbers to go with that, pedestrians were found to be 40% more likely to collide with a hybrid at low speed than a traditional vehicle, and bicyclists even more, at 70% more likely. All people are affected by this issue, especially the visually impaired. And I think that's a big reason that it's come to national attention, and we've seen so much of this in the media recently, is because people are attributing some accidents now to quiet vehicles. There's a lot of solutions that have been proposed and some that are already in place. There's infrastructure solutions, pedestrian solutions, and automotive solutions. Now, some of the infrastructure solutions, of course, we've all seen, the walk, don't walk, audible signals, the countdowns, these are all very helpful. And pedestrian solutions have been proposed as well, such as a device that can give you vibrational feedback when a car is nearby. That could be done with a microphone and some fancy algorithms, but the way it's been proposed so far is through radio frequency transmission. So not only do you have to implement something in every single automobile on the road, but every pedestrian that wants to be aware of these automobiles has to wear something. Yeah, we're not so big a fan of that solution either. The infrastructure solutions are valuable, but they cannot be implemented universally. Automotive solutions, on the other hand, can be implemented universally, and there's enormous precedence for that. Everything from safety belts to pedestrian protection that's already in legislation, how we have to design our hood so that impacts that do happen don't cause deaths. So I'll tell you a little bit about the Fisker Karma. We can go 50 miles under electric power alone before the gasoline engine turns on. And then even beyond the electric range, the Karma still has quiet operation, just like any strong hybrid. So when you're at a stoplight, the engine's going to turn off. If you're coasting, if you're going downhill, of course we don't need engine power, so we're going to save fuel. And that's where the Fisker Karma acoustic signature enhancement comes in. And we're getting some public awareness that I mentioned. There's quite a few articles and news reports that we've seen recently. Actually, we were featured in two articles just this month in the New York Times. I was pretty excited about that because I got my name in the New York Times. And something I want to communicate that isn't so obvious to people that interact with cars is enormous effort goes into the acoustic signature of every vehicle on the market. Not just these new technology vehicles, every vehicle. Ford, Mitsubishi, Honda, you name it, they all put their cars into hemianechoic chambers, and they do all kinds of benchmarking of other vehicles because people buy cars that sound nice. And I want to make sure that as we get to the point of implementing regulation, that we don't restrict the creative freedom that clean technology vehicles have to define their sound. We don't want to be put at a disadvantage. And so we still want to, you know, have that freedom, and we can still solve the problem. Now, the acoustic signature enhancement system on the Fisker Karma consists of a controller amplifier that interprets driver inputs and vehicle behavior to turn that into sound through speakers on the exterior of the vehicle. Now, what this means is that we can vary the sound character of the vehicle with things like what gear you're in, speed, of course, vehicle on, vehicle off, even things like steering angle. And varying with all those parameters is very important because the largest pushback we're getting by far on this idea of having a minimum sound in vehicles is the environmental concern. Automotive companies have been working for a long time to make cars quiet. And now we want to have a minimum sound? I mean, to some people this sounds crazy. And so in order to address both issues, the environmental concern is valid. I mean, noise pollution has been shown to cause health issues, and, well, frankly, it's annoying to be woken up by a car that's driving by your house. And so what we can do with our system is if you shift into drive, for example, and turn to the right, we can project more sound to the front right of the vehicle. Now, we're not only projecting to the front right, because it's still important that people know there's a car around if they're close to it, but they don't need to know from far away unless the car is coming at them. It's also important to have sound even during idle when the car is not going anywhere. And we're doing that not as loud because the car is not going to hit anyone when it's not moving, of course. But if the car can move momentarily, people should be aware of it. Now, you might wonder just how loud are we planning to make this system? We've all been annoyed by people blasting their stereos driving down the streets and people that have removed their mufflers and things like that. So I want to ease those fears that we are going to make this a quiet vehicle, but just not so quiet that you can't hear it coming. Now, we've benchmarked many vehicles, and so I'll just give you an idea of how loud our different modes will be. The default operation of the Fisker Karma is what we call stealth mode. It's a mode that focuses on fuel economy, and so you can get the maximum electric range out of your vehicle, and then once the gasoline engine turns on, you use minimal gasoline. And so that mode of operation within the sound field of interest, where we want to project sound, is going to sound about as loud as a Honda Civic non-hybrid. And then the sport mode, where you can reasonably assume somebody's going to, you know, put the pedal to the metal and it can pose a little more threat, we're making it about as loud as a Ford Mustang. Now, separate from designing that hardware system, we're also working on the sound itself. As I mentioned, acoustic signature is an enormous part of the brand identity of a vehicle. Impulse response is one of the technologies we're using to develop the sound. I'll show you an example of it. I have a demo that you can listen to. It's a technology that was developed for Hollywood so that you can record sounds in studio and then translate that into something that sounds like it was recorded elsewhere. Cathedral, outdoors, you name it. So what we do is we bring microphones to different locations and we characterize that environment, be it a parking garage or a parking lot or an intersection, and we see how sound bounces around. We play some pink noise, white noise, and then we can take any sound and translate it into that environment without having to revisit the environment. So this demo right here, you're going to hear... Oh, just a moment. Got to plug in. You're going to hear the studio sound, and then you will hear the sound played as it would sound through like a portable radio, and then you'll hear the sound as it would sound indoors, like in a conference room, and then you'll hear as it would sound outdoors.
Thank you.
So what that brings to us is we can create all these sounds from inspirations that we have, and we won't have to go out into the field to test it. We can just put on some headphones or play them through speakers to an audience like yourself and get feedback on how that sounds. Now, of course, we're not going to make the car growl or laugh at you. And I don't have the final sound of the Karma for you today. That's actually something we're still working on. But I'll give you an idea of some of our sources of inspiration. A lot of our inspiration comes from the actual production pre-production hardware that we have and prototypes that we have. We think it sounds pretty cool as it is, of course. You can see our prototypes already make some pretty interesting sounds. And we've also been inspired by the Dark Knight Batmobile. We think that sounds pretty cool. And actually, if you listen to it, it actually sounds kind of like our prototypes. So Batman had a pretty good idea. And now here's the sound of an F-14 jet starting up. I just love the low frequency content in this sound. And then as it gets up there, it starts to get annoying. But of course, we can choose not to incorporate any of that. And if you imagine that going backwards instead of starting up, shutting down, you can get kind of an idea of what maybe we could do for regenerative braking sounds. So there's a lot of cool stuff we can do. We also take inspiration from nature and art. We have an engine in the vehicle. It's not purely electric. And in sport mode, the engine comes on more readily. And to reflect that sporty nature, we're looking at some growls. And one of my favorite growls is that of a Jaguar. Not the car, mind you. Incredibly different from the sound of that Jaguar is the sound of the snow leopard. It is a bizarre sound, but it is absolutely beautiful. So if you heard that coming, you might get out of the road. And we also have a strong luxury aspect to our brand, and we really like the sound of the orchestral bass. Very refined and even peaceful sounding. And peaceful is a key part of our brand in that we're doing something for the environment. And now I'll talk a bit about the regulatory solution. As I mentioned, let's get some legislation together as soon as possible. Automobiles must be acoustically detectable to pedestrians when powered on. Very simple. And once we have that in place, we can continue our work on defining detectability with some metrics and test procedures. But detectability, as it's shown, is a very difficult thing to measure repeatedly. You have the source that you must consider, the car, which is the only thing that you're going to measure and regulate. But what also affects detectability is, of course, the setting that the vehicle's in, and then the perceiver. And then you get down into the perceiver, you got the physics that go on, which we're very good at measuring, and we have all kind of metrics and instruments for that. But then there's the psychoacoustics. Once it gets inside your ear and goes through your cochlea and whatnot, this starts to get a little hairy, and we have ways of dealing with it, like weighting these metrics and, you know, using time domain, frequency changes, things like that. And this is still pretty consistent throughout humanity. Psychoacoustics generally remain the same. But now psychology also factors into detectability, and that is all over the place. People can tune out sounds like crazy. I mean, I'm sure you know people that can sleep through a fire alarm. And it seems to be selective. Your unconscious is constantly keeping tabs of things, and so we need to consider that when we make legislation, although it may never be something that we can measure. Now, there's a lot of good people working on this issue of detectability, including the Society of Automotive Engineers, the Vehicle Sound for Pedestrians Committee. I am a participating member in that committee, and also a voting member. And the committee has done a lot of good work to define a test procedure to define a minimum sound of a vehicle. And that's really not as easy as it sounds. The test procedure as it stands today measures the maximum sound during quietest operation. That sounds kind of confusing, but there's still a lot that's being left up to regulators, of course, on the details. And I'll go through briefly one of the studies submitted to the committee done by a company called Sound Answers and Enhanced Vehicle Acoustics, two separate companies. They performed this study during the National Federation of the Blind California Conference. What they did is they had several different cars, actually four cars, drive by, and people raised their hand when they could detect the vehicle. Very simple. And then they could translate that into distance of detection, so between detection and potential impact, and also time, detection time. Now, counterintuitive as it is, the quietest vehicle that they measured was the earliest detected. And that's not to say that quieter vehicles are easier to detect, of course. It simply shows that there's a lot more to that equation. Something about the characteristic, excuse me, of that sound made it easy for humans to detect the car, even though it wasn't loud on the decibel scale. And we really found that there's no correlation whatsoever to the maximum sound during quietest operation and detection time. But decibels are still an important part of the equation. We just need to figure out exactly what part they are. Now, key regulatory points. We should, as I mentioned, establish that qualitative definition in legislation as soon as possible. We should maintain the freedom in acoustic signature design so as not to put clean technologies at a disadvantage to traditional technologies. And we will continue, of course, to work on quantifying detectability, but we don't know how long that will take. Now, to emphasize the urgency to get this legislation through, I want to point out that hybrid growth is not linear. It is exponential right now. In the year 2000, there were less than 10,000 hybrid vehicles sold in the U.S. In 2001, more than double that. Today, there is hundreds of thousands of hybrids sold every year. And President Obama has called for 1 million plug-in hybrids on the road by 2015. So I will repeat for the third time, automobiles must be acoustically detectable to pedestrians when powered on. Now, I would love to field some questions, so please just...
All right, just stand up and we can get to you. We got a couple of minutes for questions.
Am I correct then that Fisker Automotive has taken a position in favor of H.R. 734, the Pedestrian Safety Enhancement Act?
No. And that's because all proposed legislation that I've seen includes certain verbiage that is not quite appropriate. For example, omnidirectional is a word that's used in a lot of this legislation. Basically means that cars should emit sound in all directions. There's really no reason a car needs to emit sound up or down. You know, if you're driving through a parking garage that people live above, the people above you, of course, don't need to hear the car. So we want to make sure that when we do this, we do it right.
What thought, if any, have you given to protecting the sound-emitting apparatus? Because what I can imagine happening is people who are not educated about the reasons for these things wanting to disable this stuff.
Yeah, and even scarier than that, they're going to play their music through it. So... there's only so much we can do to protect that. In the end, you know, people are always going to do this kind of thing. It will be illegal, hopefully. But we are taking great effort. When you said protect, I thought you were going to say from the elements, because that has been a huge challenge for us to protect these speakers from things like the heat of the exhaust and the snow and the rain. Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of concerns there. But protecting them from people, even more difficult. They will not be able to use our controller hardware. I can tell you that. They'd have to be pretty darn good hackers to be able to modify that.
Okay, we're going to take two more questions. Gene's going to have one, and then so you can all sit down who have been standing. We'll get to one of you. You're one lucky person here. We just have to move on.
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
You're on.
Okay, I'm sorry. Gene Lozano. Kevin, I wanted to see if I could understand one thing you said. Would your company have any objections that after research is completed that yours and other companies would come up with one standardized sound that you have the ability to create your own way of doing it so that we out in the field will recognize it as an automobile that's coming along rather than, I know in Japan they're looking at like, your cell phone, tone ringers, you could change it, you could be musical, Mozart one day, the Beatles the next day, and so forth, to do that. And there's a reason for this, too, is when we're involved in some accidents, and I've just recently talked to law enforcement people about this, in accidents, we often have to come up, when we got to give reports and things, conflicts, we have to give other things other than what we saw, the car and so forth. And we need to be able to recognize that it's definitely this one vehicle and that it's not going to be changing where somebody can alter the sound the next day and so forth. So for an enforcement possibility and for us to be able to identify it, to have some standardization in the sound?
I would definitely agree that cars should sound like cars. So at Fisker Automotive, I can safely say supports that effort. And putting some kind of, you know, wording into the legislation like that, I think is appropriate. Having a standard sound in the sense that every car sounds the same, I would disagree with, because you can't do that with internal combustion engine vehicles.
Right. I mean, okay, I think we're not in disagreement. I think as long as it's within the family of automobile engines, that it's recognizable as a... If automobile engine is the sound that ultimately the research finds, then that be it. But it, that everyone allows, you know, you can have a sports car sound, whatever it is. But it just at least it's in the same family and it's recognizable and it's reserved for that purpose so that people don't replicate it along the sidewalk and make sounds that sound like it.
Absolutely. And actually, you mentioned Japanese automobile makers and... The Japanese Automobile Manufacturers Association is on the Vehicle Sound for Pedestrians Committee in SAE, and in their test that they've done, they have included things outside the realm of automotive sounds, but they've gotten consistent feedback that nobody likes that. So even if it's not in the legislation, you can be pretty sure that people aren't going to design cars like that because people won't buy them. And also in that study I mentioned by Sound Answers and Enhanced Vehicle Acoustics, they asked people what they preferred in sounds, and everybody prefers, this is unanimous, everybody wants cars to remain sounding like cars.
Okay, one last quick question, if we could.
Okay. Hi, I just wanted to thank you for addressing this problem, because when I first heard of hybrids coming out, I was worried about the ability for partially blind and blind people to hear them. It's important for everyone to hear cars, to know where they are, even the sighted, but
absolutely,
it also is for the blind and partially blind, and I am glad you're addressing this. It makes me feel a lot better, and I thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, let's hear it for Kevin Walsh and Fisker Automotive. It is great to see a corporation, an entrepreneurial spirit like this alive and well in this country, and with the type of social conscience that really will benefit all of us and all our concerns. Thank you again, Kevin. Okay. We're now going to have basically a panel. Instead of having two separate speakers, we'll let them sort of do their own little duet here. You know, we already had in the Rehabilitation Services Committee meeting yesterday an outstanding presentation by Jesse Lorenz on social networking. And today we're going to have a panel on the in this general session. The first speaker, I'm not going to give the long introduction of Paul Schrader, because he'll also be on in the banquet, and I'm just going to give the short version, but it's indeed an outstanding one. Paul is just a man. It's just an incredible privilege for me to know. He's been here before at one of our conventions. He's the type of person that when he speaks, I know I'm going to listen, because he has a world of expertise, and yet he's one of us. He never forgets where his roots are, and he is truly an incredible individual. He is vice president in terms of policy for the American Foundation for the Blind, and so the first panelist is Paul Schrader. The other panelist is Marcella Downing. Marcella is an attorney, I like that right away, with Hauck and Downing LLP, located in Fresno, along with her husband Robert Hauck. Their practice specializes in estate planning, including special needs, elder law, and business successions, as well as real estate and insurance fraud. Ms. Downing graduated from UC Santa Cruz and San Joaquin College of Law. She's a member of the California State Bar, the Fresno County Bar, the Wills and Trust Section of the Fresno Bar, and a member of the Trust and Estate Planning Section, as well as the Tax Section of the State Bar. She currently serves on the San Joaquin College of Law Alumni Association and is a member of the Fresno County Women's Lawyers. and various other state and local bar entities. She, in 2008, she was acting president of the San Joaquin College of Law Alumni Association. So I would like to present both our speakers, Mr. Paul Schrader and Ms. Marcella Downing.
Thanks, Jeff. Not sure how to live up to that intro. So I won't. So Marcella and I carefully scripted this just about 15 seconds ago to determine how we wanted to go, and I'll jump in with a few comments. I wish I had been here yesterday to hear Jesse's comments. And Jesse, are you in the audience? Good, so I can say whatever I want. I have a feeling we probably should have done like a pro-con, because I'm one of those people. I have two inactive accounts. One's Twitter, one's Facebook. I haven't figured out yet why I need either one, but that's not what I'm here to talk about. Not to present the con position, the why do I care position about Facebook. I'm sure that there's a reason. I saw in the Washington Post not too long ago that somebody was writing about Facebook and wondering if it's in decline. Partly because they were speculating that if Aaron Sorkin is doing a movie, it's probably in decline. And I love Aaron Sorkin, by the way. And secondly, they were sort of musing on what would it be like when the last person to friend you, and friend everyone, is Osama bin Laden. So like this is where Facebook is going. Fastest growing group apparently using Facebook is 35 and older, which is another reason perhaps why it'll die. Hey, I'm in that group. It's okay. You know, I mean, I'm with you. But I haven't quite figured it out. Either fourth or second most popular website, depending on who you listen to, and Marcella may touch on some of this too. They were in that Post article talking about something called Friendster. Anybody remember that? That was the cool kid thing back in 2003. Then it was MySpace. And I recently heard a thing about MySpace and Facebook, and there was sort of this sense of MySpace is, to quote my 19-year-old, it's ghetto. So I don't know what that means. Some of these things I never quite figured out. All right, well, I'm not here to bury Facebook in particular, just here to talk a little bit about accessibility issues. And actually, full disclosure, AFB is working with Facebook, as I think many of you know, or some of you know, on accessibility issues. Obviously, people are using Facebook. A lot of blind folks are, well, many people. How many in the audience use it? I won't ask how many of you can't figure out a reason why you would want to use it. A lot of people are using it, and I know that, and a lot of people are finding good value in it, and so clearly Facebook at some level is accessible to people with vision loss. It is possible to use. It is more than merely possible to use. It is, in fact, for many, satisfying to use. But there are accessibility barriers, and they're barriers that certainly we're hoping to work on with Facebook. I'm going to throw out some of them, and a lot of times when you talk about accessibility, you have to distinguish between accessibility and usability. Because there are some things, while strictly accessible, are not necessarily very usable, or make it requires so much effort that it's hardly worth the trouble. Now, I know there are a lot of people who will go to the trouble because they want the result. They want the buzz, the connections, the information that they get from Facebook, and I'm totally cool with that. My hope is that if we're successful at AFB, and if others are, that we're going to make Facebook and whatever succeeds it, if there is something, a whole lot more accessible. But I won't address LinkedIn or Twitter because I don't want to. No, yes, that's true. But also, LinkedIn, you know, I think probably a lot of people are using LinkedIn in the business setting. It tends to be a little more accessible. It's not as cool as Facebook, and I think people have found it to have less of its kind of barriers. Twitter, I'm not sure whether Twitter is even, in all seriousness, that important to talk about. People are using it, and aside from its audio capture, which is pretty horrid, it doesn't seem too bad. By the way, I think Facebook has a pretty good audio captcha for the audio captcha. Now, captcha is that thing, you know, that you have to type in something to separate you to prove that you're a human, which is kind of a fun thing for many of us to have to prove. I've often not succeeded in proving it. The Facebook audio captcha isn't bad, because I decided to create an account just before I came out here and talked about it, so I had some feel for the service. So usability and accessibility, there are issues, and we're, as I said, hoping to work on them. It's a cluttered environment. And I think even the devotees of Facebook would acknowledge that it and other kinds of sites like it are often fairly cluttered. There's a lot of stuff going on. It's a changing and dynamic environment. There are pop-ups and live updates and changes. And those are usability challenges, right, for those of us who are blind, who are trying to figure out what's going on, and things are happening on the screen that we don't even know about because we can only look at one section at a time, whether we're using speech or screen access device or whatever. So that's a challenge, but there are some there are some accessibility barrier challenges too, and some of these people have worked around and figured out how to deal with. For example, headings. Facebook doesn't use a lot of them, and when it doesn't use them very well, for the most part. Now, I don't know whether we would class headings as in the technical sense accessible or not, but headings are very important to a lot of blind users, and headings do make a site much more usable, much more navigable. I think most of us would probably agree. So headings is an issue with Facebook, proper use of headings in the design of the website. Links. I already mentioned that it's cluttered, but there are unlabeled links. There are poorly labeled links, links whose labels don't really mean much, like read more, etc. There are images without tags, so there are, they serve as links that you don't really know what they are. There are some oddly nested links, so that there are two or three links, and as a screen reader user, you might not know that they're there. You likely wouldn't know that they're there because of the way they're designed and structured. There are keyboard access issues. Again, this maybe falls into the category of a borderline accessibility or usability issue. A lot of folks, me included, like using keyboard access as opposed to playing around with our mouse functions. I never liked playing with mice that much anyway, and I still don't. So there are some keyboard issues. Navigation among elements can be a challenge in some of the, and by the way, much of what I'm talking about is prevalent in the user wall area, but there are other areas in Facebook where this shows up as well as issues. And something like closing the chat session has proven to have some challenges for people who want to do it from the keyboard. Live updates, I mentioned that it's a dynamic environment, and there are things that happen like notifications of news and notifications of emails and contacts, and those are not always updated for those of us who are using screen readers. There are low vision issues that we have found. The poor contrast in some instances, dependence on reverse polarity, so white on black, something like that, has proven to be a challenge for some screen access users. Some of the items do not speak in at least Zoom text, if not some of the other screen access programs. Not very clear changing of some of the status indicators. Now, in true web fashion, we're cautioned not to use color or contrast change as the only way of signaling a change in a web environment. On the other hand, it can be a useful way of signaling a change for people with limited vision. So, no, it should not be the only way, but it doesn't mean that it can't be a useful way, and it often is a useful way of signaling that. So those are some of the topics that we have chosen to tackle in trying to work with Facebook. And what I'm going to do is, I raced through that fairly quickly. I want to give Marcella a chance to maybe put Facebook back in its proper place as a wonderful, exciting, great place to go, but one where perhaps you should be cautious from a legal perspective. And then maybe we'll have a little time for questions. So let me stop there and ask if what Marcella would like to contribute.
Well, first I have to say that I got on Facebook for the first time last week. When I responded
to... She and I better friend each other.
Yeah, I think so. I think that many attorneys are by now... Is this on? Many attorneys are by nature risk adverse, and I'm no exception. So when I started watching all this going on out there, I'm thinking, I think I'll sit back and just watch for a while. And I'm glad I did. I thought when I heard that there was a request for an attorney to speak on this, I called and I fessed up that I really didn't know much about it and that I was at this point researching for our firm and would be happy to include research for you folks at the same time so that I could double up my efforts. So what I am going to speak about today is some of the advantages that I think are genuinely there and also some of the things to be concerned about. I think that in a way you have an advantage if you. How many people are on Facebook again? Can I see hands? Could you raise hands? We probably got about 150 people or maybe 200 in the room, and I'd say maybe 20 or 30.
Wow.
Does that look like it? So I couldn't wait to hear about accessibility issues because my mind was boggling how all of you use this. I probably have a special need in that I'm grossly sight dependent. My assistant will tell you I can't remember anything unless I write it down. And heaven forbid I lose my notes while I just write it down again. So social networking. When I started looking into what this really meant, I realized that I didn't know where to draw the boundaries because everything is so connected to so many other things. There's a reason they call it the web. It's quite a tangled web. So some of the joys that I found, I've actually in my 1 week on Facebook with my great experience here found a friend. I did. I found a friend I hadn't heard from since junior high school, and I'm 52. So there you go. It's been a while, and. My colleagues and people that I've talked to on this say it's a great way to build awareness of you, who you're about, your business, what your business is about, and your organization. And Jean told me that this organization is very organically driven, that you as members change and grow the organization from the grassroots up. So I'm going to speak to you today about some of the ways that these networks can be used for you personally and also for the organization. So they're also great tools, in my opinion, for education and for building memberships and groups, for team building. There's actually sites where you can go on and essentially do real-time brainstorming from all over the world in a group on the web. Of course, people make money on the web, and it's an incredible way to leverage your time, your money, and your knowledge. Social networking, the things that I looked into were a variety of different kinds of blogging, like it's essentially like having a soapbox in the middle of town square, only the town is now the world. And it includes video, and there's a radio blog site where you can essentially create your own radio station. Yeah, I know. Very cool. Social networks can be limited to the social group that you want to contain them within, or they can be very public, completely open to everyone. There's MySpace, which tends to be more younger demographics. There's Facebook, which I think you probably know more about the demographics there than I do. Twitter, I think you're going to relate to this. Somehow I managed to get signed into Twitter, and I've got people I don't even know following me, and I'm not going anywhere. So I hope they're having a good time. And I'm not LinkedIn to LinkedIn. I've been invited to LinkedIn, and I will tell you in a few minutes why I'm not LinkedIn to LinkedIn. Then, of course, there's websites. We have a website. For those who I completely still do not understand how you get on the web, I really would like to learn more. We moved here about 15 years ago, just a little bit about me personally. We moved here from Sacramento about 15 years ago. And when we moved here, one of our friends was a doctor at Kaiser said, you're moving to the most diverse city in the country. And I said, you're kidding me, Fresno? And she said, yes, it's the most diverse city. And she studied this because she's an infectious disease specialist, so she tracks diseases and how they pass between communities. And however, she said not that we were diseased, let me just... but that we probably had great restaurants. we do, yes. So when we moved here and we started looking at setting up a website, we said, well, how can we serve the community? Our website needs to look like our community. And so we very consciously chose a variety of pictures for our website that hopefully people would look at our site and see someone in there that at least looked similar to them. Of course, we couldn't do that completely or there'd be nothing but pictures on the front page. and then, of course, there's webinars. There's books that are published online and sold online. You can sell your products and you can sell other people's products. Cyberspace is pretty much like regular space, only on steroids. You can do all of the things you would do normally and do them instantaneously and time them for when they come out. There's actually, I found a website where if you've got a variety of different blogs, you just have something you want the world to know about, you can get on this other website and coordinate all your different blogs to be updated with the same information or similar information, I guess. I haven't done this myself yet. And then there's another website that will time the release of these blogs so that when you've updated them, they don't all come out at the same time and barrage everybody at the same time, which I thought was an incredible marketing tool and educational tool. If people forget, they need to keep in mind what you have to say. And if you say it once in this world with so much chatter out there, people just forget, especially if they're not writing it down. So it's an incredible vehicle. It has a lot of potential. But I would say, and this is a big but, measure twice and cut once. You know how they tell you to tell you when you're building something, you should measure the board first several times before you cut, because once you cut, once you've pushed the send button, it's sent. It is sent. And actually, I think that in the world of cyberspace, things move so rapidly that this community may have an incredible advantage. Incredible advantage. If you're not in the system yet, if you're not online yet, you can think through how you want to show up. There are actually social media strategists. We've been meeting with, I took a class from two of them and met with another one, because we really want to make sure that when we show up in a way that does not fail to represent who we are. And worse yet, might represent us in a way we really don't want to be seen. So, measure twice, cut once. Think about what you want to say before you say it. And plan. The law is a reactive animal, and so the laws regarding the Internet have not developed at the rate that the Internet's developed. But we do have something. There's a misunderstanding to think that people are not going to be held accountable for the things they do on the Internet. They are. We have such a thing called e-discovery now, and attorneys have got to turn over, when they go through discovery, people may have to turn over their computers, may have to turn over files. There's a lot of new laws that have been passed so that we are learning to deal with the Internet. Don't be lulled into thinking that you should just act. So, like I said, you've got the advantage of really being almost forced to slow down, I would think. From what I can imagine my mind's eye, I'm not walking in your shoes, but I would imagine that because of the barriers that you have, you are being forced to slow down. And there are a lot of people out there that would have been really wise to slow down a long time ago. You know, employers are looking at what were on the posted on those Facebook pages. Within 24 hours, when I started up my Facebook page, I went through those privacy settings. And I looked and I set everything so that no one could write anything on my page. I got some feedback that wasn't real positive about that. But the reason was I do not want to inadvertently pass along false or misleading information, slanderous information, libelous information. You know, slander being verbal and libel being written. And really, in a way, we have both on the Internet. We've got the verbal interaction and we've got written. So these are things to be concerned about, and I didn't even know yet that I had managed to successfully block all of these things when one of the persons that I friended, who I guess this tells you what the word friend means on Facebook, I really didn't know her that well, obviously, she sends through a post of a very scantily clad, well, perhaps not clad whatsoever, young man with things covering vital spots that left your imagination running wild. And I was having a heart attack, thinking that everyone that I had friended had just been exposed to this young lady that was not really thinking through the push button results, you know, when she pushed send. So I've already mentioned that we need to be concerned about slander and libel. Obviously, we have to be concerned about negligent and intentional inflection of emotional distress. I was fairly distressed. copyright and trademark infringement. Copyrights in a nonprofit organization, you might, as an organization, develop material that you will want to have copyrighted. And that copyright will have to, if you raise money with that copyright, that money will have to go to your nonprofit purpose. So, but copyrights have to be monitored, and they're much more difficult to monitor on the web. You can use Google diagnostics. There's a Google has a feature that will allow you to Google some certain names. You can keep track of when your name's used to see if you've been slandered or libeled. And then I've got so much to tell you in so little time. And I want to leave time for questions, too. By the way, I wear this red stop sign jacket. For those of you that are partially sighted, at least anybody should be able to see me in the room if you have sight. I brought my partner and my assistant, and we'll be in the back of the room. So if you don't get a question answered, we'll be happy to stay and do what we can to answer questions afterwards. So trademark infringement, that's where as a nonprofit, you have an identity and you have a nonprofit status that you want to protect. So if someone is using your name to raise money, that could jeopardize your nonprofit status. And particularly if they're saying we're raising money for, and then they're using this as a means of, yeah, they may be raising money for you, but they're raising money for their for-profit venture. And the Attorney General does monitor the websites to pick up that information, and it is a way that nonprofits can lose their nonprofit status. Let's see. Also, a charity can inadvertently trigger unrelated business taxable income, and that can cause them to lose their nonprofit status with because the income that's being raised. Okay, let me give you an example. Suppose on your website as an organization, you put a link through to a profit-raising organization. That link through could potentially cause an attack on your nonprofit status because you've now redirected someone out. Privacy issues. I started this out thinking, okay, I'm going to get on all these different sites and figure out what all their privacy rules were. Oh, my goodness, forget that. This is what attorneys get bad reputations for. These privacy policies, when you read through them, first of all, I venture to say most people don't read them and probably should. The things that are captured, there's a lot of information that can be captured, and generally speaking, many of the privacy policies on websites state that they can at any time change their privacy policy, and it's your responsibility to check their site, not their responsibility to contact you. Now, I think that that's an area that I'm hoping the law will catch up to, because there's no way that we could all go to every site and check every site that we've been on and see if their privacy policy's changed. Identity theft. That's obviously a growing problem. The problems that we see associated with the internet are skimming. ATM machines. Heard about skimming from ATM machines. There's also phishing from your email. You've got emails that send out requests for you to send them information. They may sound like they're the bank or they're your email provider or whatever. What they're wanting to do is to get your confidential information. Spoofing. You think you're on a website and it's not the real website. It's not what it looks like. So they can make a website look just like, say, B of A's website, but you're not really at B of A, so you're putting in information. So one of the ways you want to check to see if it's the real website is there are some symbols, VeriSign, and there's a number of different agencies that will verify that you're at the real site. And I'm not saying VeriSign is the best. I really don't know. Farming, I don't know a lot about this. I didn't have time to research this too far, but I understand that there's a way, there's some kind of scams out there that'll entice you to then go to that fake website. It's probably the phishing equivalent of getting you to go to a site. And some of these sites, when you get on the site, they will download a virus in and of itself. So, of course, spyware, virus protection, all the rest, hacking. And then there's the good old-fashioned unauthorized copying of information just within your office or organization. So income issues. If you're raising money on the internet, it's just like raising money in the real world. You need to be concerned, as I said already, how you're raising your money and how it's being used in a nonprofit organization. And then as an individual, I would assume that many of you may have public benefits that you're able to access. And so if you're raising money, the potential for raising money on the internet is astounding. You may end up raising so much money that you could disqualify yourself for public benefits. So what you'd want to do is, if you're going to be raising money on the internet, plan ahead, put together a special needs trust. That's the part I do know about. And make sure that money gets transferred into a vehicle that will protect your public benefits. And then spamming. There are laws that were passed in 2003 that allow us to cut off some of the problems we've had with spamming, or that's the theory anyway. I certainly get plenty of it still. But if you're going to send out a newsletter via email, you might want to hire a company like Constant Contact to help you make sure that you are not sending emails to people that don't want them. Okay. I did that as fast as I could.
Great job.
You were
going
to say something about LinkedIn.
That was great.
Oh. LinkedIn, I guess I dropped the ball on that one.
What you have specific reason why you weren't?
Oh, yes. When I was originally asked about to join LinkedIn, someone asked me to you know, they sent me that invitation you get on email saying, come see so-and-so on LinkedIn. They want to be linked to you. Well, I went in, and I could not, for the life of me, find where LinkedIn was. I mean, I couldn't find out who it was. I was going to have to give them access to all my email. In other words, all my email contacts they were going to link in. I think they may have changed this by now. This was quite a long time ago. And the last week, I did link onto their site, and I saw at least a city and state that they were based out of. I didn't spend a lot of time looking at it, but my first inclination, I guess my first warning to you, is guard your privacy. guard your privacy and guard your friend's privacy, because if that privacy, if you're entrusted with confidential information like social security numbers or credit card numbers or someone else's personal information, and it gets out, you can be held liable, and you have a requirement to tell the person whose confidentiality has been breached, that it has been breached.
Okay, so we have time for a few questions. Don't leave quite at the end. We're going to have I'm going to ask Marcella for a second if she'll pick a couple of door prizes at the very end. So don't run away. Maybe she'll pick her own name.
Hey Jeff, before as we're getting the mic to a questioner, just two quick things that I neglected to say. One is that Facebook does do, and I think is working on, really trying to address accessibility. And I know there's a lot of information on the site, and of course a lot of people like the mobile. How many people use the mobile version of Facebook primarily? Yeah, I think I should have said that up front. A lot of people find that to be easier to use or more accessible. It's much more well-behaved HTML, a little bit less cluttered, and a little bit less of the dynamic problems. And the other thing, just a quick shameless plug, don't want people to forget that AFB has a thing called Access World, a technology web-based magazine. And frankly, we haven't done enough on social networking in there, but Janet Ingberg did a nice article back in the spring on Facebook, and I'm hoping we'll get around to doing some more social networking stuff to give you some advice. And if you want to hear that, see that kind of stuff, please let us know. We do have a survey up, actually, where we're trying to get input on what you want in Access World, so we'd love to hear from you.
So, hello.
All right.
Can I put in one shameless plug, too, then?
Hello.
You get attorney
Hold
starting.
On, Roger.
You get attorney starting. You know we don't want to shut up. So along the same lines, our website is www.hauk-downing.com, and I'm going to be working to try to figure out how we can make our website accessible, because we do aim to educate. So I'm not so sure that it is accessible right now.
Thank you. Okay, questions.
So, I don't know whether this mic is working or not.
You're alone, Roger.
Sure. I just wanted to say to you, Paul, that I'm one of those people who can't imagine why I would ever want to get on Facebook. And part of the reason is that I just got an email the other day that was a reminder of all the people who have invited me to be on Facebook. And one of them is the mayor of Mountain View, and another is Jerry Brown. But the other thing is, it occurred to me when you talked about Facebook being cluttered, being chaotic, being mislabeled, I said, well, that's probably the way it's intended to be. It sounds like TGI Fridays. So I wonder if we make it better, you know, nobody will like it anymore.
Okay, anyone else? Okay, well, I want to thank you both very much.
Someone
give a hand
back
to both of our great speakers. Yes. Ken, the streamer, Mr. Metz. We had some streaming problems earlier.
Yeah,
we're streaming now, I hope.
Yeah, we are streaming. We'll say hello tonight. We finally got, I don't know what happened. I took off for a little while, like about 20 minutes, came back, and all of a sudden there was no interference. So have no idea what happened, but we're straightened out. We are streaming. We'll say hi to the world tonight. And also at the 10 o'clock news, when we are having our elections tonight, KMPH TV out here is going to do an article on us. They came and interviewed several folks here this afternoon.
They did a great interview with Steve Fraser. I don't know if he's still in the room, but let's hear it for Steve Fraser, the new employee from the city of Fresno. The great job he did. Okay. And even Ken Metz, they did an interview with him. I guess they reduced their standards for him, but they allowed him anyway.
Hey, listen, I'm the one that contacted him after on the follow-up, so I brought the organization way up.
Okay, session of the the first general session of the California Council of the Blind Convention is hereby adjourned, and will reconvene at 7 p.m. Thank you.